Hi and welcome to Shifters Podcast. Today's guest is Melissa Mills. She is the Director of Product Management at Ardoc. And just before that, she was the Director of Product Management at Kahoot. And before that, she worked at a startup called Involve. And before that, she was 8 years at Google as a global product lead. Well, welcome, Melissa.
Now you're making me sound old.
Yeah, but you're definitely not old.
No.
Like I just said before we started, that you have like this superhero name, Melissa Mills.
Oh, yes. That's because you said the alliteration, which I did not know until now.
Yeah. And it's really, really cool name. So how are things at Ardoc these days, Melissa?
Things are good. We're in the crux of Q3 planning. So it's always intense, but it's always really fun to think about what you're going to build next. So it's exciting times.
Yeah. And actually, Eric, your CEO, has been on this podcast before.
Oh, no way. Yeah. So, now I feel really cool.
Yes. But you're sort of more of like an operator. You actually execute in the every day with the product managers at Ardoc. So what is a director of product management? What does she do?
Yeah, for sure. At Ardoc, I'm covering the product teams as well as the design teams, and I am making sure we get our stuff built. So I get a lot of feedback from the leadership and the executive suite, and they help infer and provide guidance in what we need to prioritize. And then I work with these teams in coaching and managing them to make sure we build really cool stuff for our customers.
So Ardoc is a B2B company.
Yeah.
But you used to work at Kahoot, which is a B2C company. Is there a difference there? In terms of product management?
So typically, in the biggest difference or the most general thread between B2B and B2C is that in B2B, the decision maker isn't necessarily the end user. So in B2B, the person purchasing the product might be the CIO, but then the day-to-day users might be the enterprise architects in the case of Ardoc. Mm. In B2C, your direct user is the purchaser. So at Kahoot, it was that same sense. And then like at Google, it was technically a B2B product. Our customers were these companies, but they were ultimately selling to either additional companies or to individuals. So when I was at Google, I worked on our apps products, and our customers were major app companies like Facebook and Lyft and Uber. And so we had to not only understand the B2B side of things, but also the B2C.
Yeah, but is it difference in terms of product management as a field, or is it sort of the same, but just different?
Yeah.
Stakeholders and customers.
Good question. I think you have to make decisions a bit differently. So for example, at Kahoot, you literally have billions of players and tens of millions of daily active users. And so then it's about using that data to then provide guidance into how to make good product decisions. Whereas in B2B companies, Ardoc doesn't have 15 million users or something, for example. No. So then we might have different feedback and guidance. We may have contracts that are about to expire, or we may have new customers we're trying to close, and then we need to figure out how to make our product work for all these different contracts. And then we might work with customer success managers to help us in collecting that feedback.
So it's more of a manual feedback loop.
It is. The data's there, but it's not going to be at the same volume. And so you have to use a combination of insights to be able to prioritize. And in B2B, you very well could be in situations where a large portion of the revenue is being driven by a handful of customers, and you might want to weigh their feedback more heavily than others.
Yeah.
To make sure you can continue renewal and even increase subscriptions.
So ironically, when you're working B2C, you are actually receiving data, which you can analyze. But when you're working B2B, you actually need to be more of a people's person to understand what the person behind the title actually needs.
Totally. You always need qualitative and quantitative feedback. But the idea is that with B2C, you're dealing with large volumes. And so if I do purely qualitative feedback, I might not get enough of a comprehensive view of the pool. Hmm. So what I would do is probably start with the data, look at the volume, and then use that to infer some insights and then validate those insights with focus groups or focus feedback.
Oh. So do you do everything that does a product manager do everything? Like from collecting data and do interviews to actually create the product?
I would say no, because we need a lot of help.
Yeah.
I feel like our job is essentially to at the end of the day, everyone's job at the company is to make sure we're building good products for our users. There's the Google mantra, focus on the user. That couldn't be more true. It's really critical that everyone, whether it's an engineer, whether it's a data person, whether it's the customer or even the product manager, has to be focused on the user. Where product management fits in is our job is to make sure we're delivering good value to our customers and growing the revenue in the process and creating this good path. So if we have certain departments that can support us in that process, awesome. If there's some departments that need more help, then yeah, you need to roll up your sleeves and figure out how you can help, because we need to make sure that we're building good solutions and everyone's part of that process. And if one particular group or department is struggling, then we all need to work together to make sure that we can work collectively to make this happen. We all need each other. So there's no way product management can do it all, but our job is to make sure that we fill the gaps and we support wherever we need to ensure that this path is created.
So are you like also an advocate for the user?
Yeah, but everyone at the company should be an advocate for the user. Like, we are all, if it weren't for our users, we would not be here. This company would not exist.
But that mantra, the user, put the user in focus.
Yeah.
Yeah. So why do you have to say that? Isn't that obvious?
I think in some ways it is obvious, but in some ways, you know, we're all human. We get caught up in stuff, you know, having to fix a bug or getting caught up in making sure we get a report so that end of year expenses are addressed. You get caught up in a lot of the day to day. And even as product managers, we do too. We're human.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah, I know, right? But the idea then is we all have to look out for each other. And as a product manager, you're in a unique position where you can essentially see the entire assembly line. And so you're in an advantage to be able to help and support in making sure that user centricity exists. Yeah. So if we didn't help like that, then we would be doing the company a disservice.
Yeah. Okay. So how
hope
do you,
that's okay.
yeah. Great. So how do you create this product roadmap? What is a product roadmap? How do you create it?
Totally. Each company has different ways of setting up product roadmaps. I really love following a quarterly model where we build a roadmap every quarter. We do planning every quarter. So like I said, we're in the middle of Q3 planning now to decide what we're going to build. In a kind of dream scenario where there's no interruptions, no externalities, you could scope all the opportunities proactively, build estimates, and then build a roadmap that then highlights the top solutions based off these problems you've assessed.
So you suggest, for example, at the start of the year, these are the type of products we're going to create this year.
Yeah, or like, again, user centricity. The idea is at the start of the year, you go, okay, this is our user journey. We see a ton of attrition at these different stages. There's clearly something that's a problem for the user here. How can we solve that problem? So then we go, okay, these are the top three problems we have to address. And then product works in planning to think, okay, then these are the solutions we're going to build for these three problems.
But is it like do you work a year at a time?
It depends. At Google, we could, because we felt it was more of a waterfall approach. Literally, you could release, if you released even an update that had a bug in it that could impact users and cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. So the scale of impact was so significant, everything had to be thoroughly planned. So we took took caution in what we released. But in a startup and a scale up, where you don't necessarily have that same luxury for time. You know, if I planned everything out perfectly in a year, and never created any opportunity to adapt that roadmap in a year, that would be really difficult for the stakeholders and the leadership and the executives. Because what if something comes down from the investors? What if there's some major thing a competitor does? There'd be no inflexibility there. And we need to make sure this business can survive beyond a year. So that adaptability is really critical.
So you need the shorter, what do you call it, cadence?
I would love to get to a point where we have so much predictability that I can anticipate what we're going to do a year from now. We're not there yet. At least I haven't found that dynamic yet.
Yeah. Okay. So it's like, so you have quarterly.
Quarterly's great because, you know, things take time to build. Like engineering takes time to build things and to make sure it's executed and implemented properly. So you could typically release a decent amount of stuff in a quarter. And it gives you a great opportunity to do an assessment. Like, this is a significant amount of work we've released. Did this add value? Did this improve the situation? What could we have done better? Mm-hmm. And then there's this whole concept of retrospectives that product managers use to evaluate. I love retrospectives. It gives you a chance to formally review and have an honest conversation about what can be done better. And it helps keep things in check to make sure what you're doing is in the right direction.
So do you like apply this retrospective after the launch of a product, or do you apply it during the quarter?
Yeah. So you can do them after the launch of a product. Sometimes they're called pre and postmortem. Sometimes they're called retrospectives. I always do that after a feature launch, but I like to do them monthly and throughout the quarter as well. Yeah. That way it gives me a pulse. So even if we've kind of agreed upon something, if we need to adjust, if we don't want to waste another 2 months on something that may not be working, we have literally this monthly meeting to make sure that we can keep each other honest on that. And I love that because then I can adapt faster and yeah. I can make adjustments faster and I can create a good feedback loop with the day-to-day people I work with that I can then align with the leadership on. Yeah. So then if they are concerned or maybe we have to squeeze something in the roadmap, I know what's feasible or not feasible because I have this regular cadence with the day-to-day operations.
Yeah. So basically, for example, yeah. let's say at January, yeah. you have identified these three major problems, which are keeping the user from, for example, using the product. For example,
yeah,
the three most important things you need to develop to yeah. make the product better for the user.
Yeah,
but you have only resources to do one of those.
Yeah,
so we will talk later about prioritization. So you choose one.
Yeah,
and what do you do then in this quarter? What does the first week look like, and what does the weeks look like in terms up until you launch the product?
Yeah, for sure. So I'm trying to give a good example. So like, for example, at RDoC, as a product manager, you have to not only be involved in the execution, but also in that planning, like you're talking about, and deciding what to prioritize and what to build. And oftentimes, if you're investing in defining the problem and really understanding the problem, and then building a plan around that, that can minimize surprises. Because the challenge is you're never working with perfect information. Even if we're planning and we pretend it's perfect and we know what we're doing, there's always things that come up. Maybe there's some major technical roadblock that we uncovered in the execution. Maybe in the design, we realize we missed a really critical step in the design process, or a design component is missing. Like, things happen. So the more planning you have up front, the better. And it's a balance because we can't plan forever. So a great example is at RDoC, we have gotten a lot of user feedback around how our onboarding process can be challenging. And so it's about how can we improve that onboarding process. And so we worked closely with not just product managers, but we had some engineers to help provide some guidance. And we've scoped out what we think is a really good solution to the problem to address that. And the plan is we have a team that's dedicated to working on that next quarter. And throughout this quarter, as they work on it, they're going to uncover different challenges, different nuances. Maybe this, you know, it's about basically the access pattern. So maybe there's a point in which we need to make some decision, like maybe the traversal isn't working, so we need to make some adjustments, or maybe we realize through user testing of the traversal that we prototyped that may not work. We have to adapt to those changes. And so over the quarter, we'll plan for that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It makes sense, totally. And
is that helpful? Is that a clear example?
Yeah. So we actually also talked about this before we started to record.
Yeah.
All the shit happens.
Totally. Like a great example is like literally I joined RDoC, and then the month I joined RDoC, OpenAI kind of came up. Yeah. And what we realized is that AI is amazing. I had done machine learning in my past job. I've done the Andrew Ng machine learning courses and coded in that. It's definitely an incredible tool to make sure we're building better solutions and products.
Yeah.
But in this situation, if we were like, nope, sorry, this is our roadmap for 3 months, we're not going to change anything, That's doing us a disservice to our users.
Yeah.
So when ChatGPT came out and opened up this incredible wealth of opportunity with large language models, we realized we had to do something we had to leverage this information. We had to use these incredible resources to build better solutions.
Yeah.
And so we did a hackathon, and we came up with our engineering team came up with some really incredible ideas, and we're able to put them out in the market and able to get demos out in a short period of time for our customers. if we had stuck to our roadmap, this would have taken, then our customers would have waited even longer to get these great resources.
Yeah.
And that's not fair to them.
No.
So we have to be able to adapt to that.
Yeah. So how do you find idea? How do you find the solutions? So you have the problems. you mentioned the hackathon.
Yeah. So I feel like that's the million-dollar question for product management.
Yeah.
It's tough. There's no perfect answer for that. Like, you know, when you're learning product management, you might take a product management course. You might go, okay, here's this ShapeUp framework. Here's the Reforge framework. Here's all these different models. This is what I'm going to implement. But in reality, at the end of the day, the world's imperfect. We have imperfect information and we're trying to adjust as best we can. So one challenge I have is how I'm trying to plan in a situation that's constantly changing. There's often this analogy of trying to assemble the airplane while it's up in the air. You hear that one a lot.
But let's say it was a perfect utopia.
Perfect utopia. Okay.
Yeah. And you are trying to find a solution to a problem.
Yeah.
What are different strategies to actually do that?
Got it. Okay. I think the first step is making sure you have a really clear definition of the problem. When you're getting customer feedback, customers have a tendency to say what they want in the form of solutions.
Yeah.
You know, oh, this feature isn't working. I want this the way company X has this.
Yeah.
And so you're already getting imperfect feedback. And as a product manager, it's so easy and so tempting to just be like, oh, well, we just need to build, you know, we just need to build X for this. This will solve this. And the idea then is you're not really building for a problem. You're building for a solution. And so as you start to build, you don't have that clarity and focus on what the problem is.
Do you think that's a big problem?
100%. 100%.
No, I mean, do you think a lot of companies are actually doing this?
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's so tempting.
Why is it so tempting?
Well, we all want to do the right thing. We all want to build good solutions for our users. We all want to implement things quickly and effectively. So sometimes it's really easy to say, oh, of course, like this customer has issue A. Of course, we need to build B. Let's just build B.
Yeah. Let's just cancel the sprint. We have the solution.
Yeah.
Our customer told us the solution.
But then the challenge with that is as you're building, you don't have a good definition of what you're trying to solve. And then you don't have a good way of measuring whether or not you're solving is actually working.
Yeah.
So then what happens is you have this thing called scope creep. What that means is as you're building, maybe in the process, an engineer is building something. They'll go, oh, this actually impacts this section of the platform. What do we do? Oh, you're right. It impacts that section. Let's add that to part of the scope.
Yeah.
Or, oh, this thing, it has tentacles, essentially. It constantly expands.
So this solution becomes a huge monster.
Correct. And then you're building forever. And again, typical thing. I think everyone goes through this. I've been through this. Every product managers have made this mistake at some point. And to be honest, we all make this mistake because it's so easy to solution so early. So this is where you really have to stop yourself and check yourself and really focus on the problem. So this is where defining the user problem, focusing on user stories is so critical.
What is a user story?
A user story is when you describe the situation as a user. So for example, I would say, what's a good example?
Take an example from Kahoot, a user story from Kahoot.
Okay. So as a participant, when I'm trying to log into the game, I have a hard time accessing the game. What's a pin? The idea is the simple answer is, oh, you're trying to find the pin. Let me just put this right up in front. But when you put it in a user story, you realize that it puts the product manager not in the focus of, I need a solution. I need to get my job done. I need to work. It puts them in the perspective of the user. So then you can better identify the user problems. Again, that mantra, focus on the user. It helps you think like a user. And then by going through that user journey, you can then better understand the root cause of the problems. So rather than trying to build rather than solutioning for feedback, you're basically trying to solution against a root. So I'm trying to think of
So user story is a description of the problem from the user's perspective.
Correct. And everyone needs to think this way because, again, that's not the way we think in a day-to-day basis. When you're running your company, you're thinking about all the operations you have to deal with, all of the meetings you have to have today, what kind of issues you're getting or what kind of feedback you need to kind of grow your subscription base. The idea is that when you change that mantra and you think about it as a user, it changes that mindset. We're not programmed to think like that on a day-to-day basis. So the more we think like that, then the more we can improve it. And going back to my point about how everyone needs this kind of extreme ownership, we all need to think like this. Engineering should be thinking about users in the user story. Sales should be thinking about users in the user story. When I'm working with our sales teams and our commercial teams at Ardoc, I always ask them to tell me their situation in a user story.
Have you been in a company, you need to mention the names, but have you been in a company where not everyone is thinking about users?
Every company I've been in, it's like I said, it's a constant practice. Like,
why is the gravitation away from the customer?
I don't think it's away from the customer. It's just, we have so much responsibilities we have to do every day. Yeah. Like, I imagine we're all resourced to be efficient and be thoughtful with our time. And I've never met a person who hasn't had to work late one day.
Yeah.
Like, that happens to everyone. You have a lot of stuff. And then on top of that, like me, I have to go home to my kids after this.
Yeah. So the problem with companies are humans.
Yeah, exactly. And again, we're all human. Like, yeah, human error is a thing. Like, we are 100% prone to human error. Like, I'm not a perfect product manager. I make a ton of mistakes, but I hope that I have teams that are also helping me catch my mistakes and warning me about it so that we're supporting each other.
Okay, sorry. I deflected. I took a detour there.
No, we did take a little one. But
yeah, but you were user stories. You have to explain the problem in the user story. And
correct,
don't take the user's suggestion to a solution as a...
Totally. And again, like I said, we're prone to human error, we're prone to mistakes, and we're even prone to solution earlier. Everyone wants to be adding value. Everyone wants to come up with good ideas.
How do you know we have the right solution? When do you have the right solution?
That's a great question. Sometimes you don't. That's why you have to do user testing and you have to do validation. And
so you have a user story, and so let's say you have a user story.
Yeah.
Which how do you know this is a good user story?
So typically, like I said, even before you go to the user story, you have the problem definition. What's the problem we're trying to solve? Users can't get beyond the onboarding flow, as an example. And then the idea is, well, what does that mean? And then that's where you break it up in user stories. And you would talk about all the different types of users, sometimes as a participant, as an admin logging in as a host. If you're like Facebook, for example, you're probably thinking about it as a marketplace, as a user. Or at Google, we were thinking about it as advertisers, as end users, as individuals on search. And so you think about all the different user stories. Anyone that can interact with this problem, you write down all of those user stories.
Okay, so let me rewind a little bit.
Yeah.
So how do you know when something is a problem?
That goes back to the performance. So for example, and that's where the data, that goes back to the data and qualitative conversations. So when I'm trying to decide what to build, I want to make sure that my users are, actually taking a step back even further, there's this thing called a happy path. What that is essentially is, it's used in engineering. It's, you want to make sure whatever you're building, the most critical path for the user is always operational and always working. We call it the happy path. It has to exist. It has to be always operational. That happy path is essentially the path the user to beginning to get to that really critical moment that adds value to them. Sometimes I like to call it the aha moment.
Yeah.
Like when you're using a product and you go, ah, this is why it was valuable.
Hmm.
That's essentially what the value prop of the product is. And so when you're creating this aha moment, you want to track that path to get you there. And then if you're seeing a ton of attrition through that path, that means less and less users are getting to that really powerful moment.
What does attrition mean?
Attrition. It means that as you're losing users on that path. So for example, like if you're a application and you're trying to sell stuff, like if you're trying to, or like I'll use Kahoot. Kahoot's a great example. Like, we know the most powerful part of the product is when a teacher hosts a game. So we call it a host. Like, you want to be able to get them to host a game in their classroom. Because when they launch the game and they host it in the classroom and the kids are playing, you see the energy. You see the value of the product. It's that moment you see why people want to use this product every day. And so what's the path to getting to hosting a game? They have to log in. They have to create an account. They have to sign up. They have to find a Kahoot. They have to choose to play the Kahoot. Or maybe they create a Kahoot themselves. It's specific for their lecture.
So this is the most valuable path then?
Correct.
That's like the product market fit path.
Correct. But sometimes users lose that path. Maybe the teachers give up on the sign-on flow. Maybe they decide, oh, nope, I don't understand how to host this game. One thing we found when we were working at Kahoot is we found in certain steps of the game that if we remove some of those steps, we saw an increased likelihood that a teacher would host.
But how do you know it's a problem? Because some people are making it, right?
Some people are.
So yeah. How do you know if it's a problem in terms of how many people?
So sometimes you can gauge that just through the data, like, oh, look at these drop-off rates. These are quite high. This should be...
How do you know if it's high drop-off rate?
Benchmarks.
Not a normal one.
Benchmarks, general data. But you can also validate that through customer feedback. Mm. Again, this is where you need qualitative and quantitative feedback.
Yeah.
Sometimes you'll hear customer's feedback. I don't understand where to start. I'm confused. How do I launch a game? I don't know where to find the games.
Is there like a benchmark in terms of drop-off? Shouldn't it be is there a universal benchmark? At least 10% should move on to the next step.
Yeah, I think there's no such thing as 100%.
No.
Like 100% users continue on to the next step. I've never seen that in my life. I think the benchmarks are quite... there isn't really a universal knowledge, in my opinion. There's probably some articles on the internet that'll say, yes, there is, and this is what it should be, yeah. But I haven't figured that out yet.
I mean, like, if no one uses your product, it's a good indication it's a problem.
Exactly. Then I would argue you don't have product market fit.
Yeah.
That's another challenge.
Yeah. But if, like, let's say 100 people starts the journey and then 10 finishes it, I wouldn't know if that's a problem or not.
But that's where you can ask for user feedback. So out of those 90, why did you stop?
Yeah.
You know, and then so if you hear the same theme every time, then you have a clear drop off. There's clearly a problem.
Okay, so this is a good process.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. You see something that you think is a problem.
Yeah.
Then you need to validate that, right? Yeah. Through customer feedback, yeah. Because you don't know if it's a problem.
Correct. Okay. But again, you don't always have a ton of data with a B2B company like we talked about.
Yeah.
So then you might get a ton of customer feedback, and then you might see a common theme, and then you go, "Oh, I'm going to dive into this. Yeah. Like, I'm gonna double click on this."
Mm.
And then the idea is that I will then look at some of the data in the system, look at the performance and see, well, what are all my other customers doing? And then I can see if there's a continuous behavior. So it's about kind of leaning on both of them. And then the idea is, the next problem to solve is essentially, okay, there's clearly a problem here. What's actually happening? And that's where the user stories come in. And that's where you want to think about as many user stories as possible that really reflect that problem. What if you're coming in as a decision maker, like a CIO? What if you're coming in as an enterprise architect? Or in Kahoot's instance, that's for RDoC. In Kahoot's instance, it's like, what if I'm coming in as a teacher? What if I'm coming in as a student? What if I'm coming in as a, you know, personal user for fun? And then you think about all of those user stories. And then based off of that, you would work with your cross-functional team, engineering, design, you would work together to then really try and understand what's going on. Why is it breaking? Is it a technical issue? Is it a user flow issue? And then you would work together to figure out what a potential solution could be.
Okay, so the problem is a high drop-off at the stage. The user story is an explanation of that problem in terms of the user.
Yeah, it's like the why.
Yeah.
Like, as a user, this is what I go through. And then you go, oh, that explains why this is a problem.
Okay, and then when you have the user story, then let's say you nail the user story. Let's say you put it into the machine and the machine says, yes, it's the right user story.
Yep.
How do you now create the solution?
Yep. So then as a user story, you have a very clear definition. So then you can put key performance indicators, like metrics, against it. So, okay, I realize that users aren't able to host the game because of these extra steps we create. So let's set a goal of figuring out a solution that can decrease the number of steps to launching a game by one or by two clicks. And then now you have a very clear defined scope and a clear defined objective and good context behind those objectives. And now the team can work in figuring out how to solve that. And whatever solution we build, we can test, we can use user interviews, we can release it on an A/B test, you can release it behind a feature flag. And you have a very clear way of measuring whether or not that's going to add value or not. Because you put together success criteria.
So you don't know if the solution is going to work.
No.
No.
So I would love to think that every solution I built has been perfect, but no. You never know. Like, you never know how users are going to respond. You're not the end user at the end of the day. You're trying your best to be them, but you're ultimately not them.
Okay, so the results on the KPIs will tell you if it works or not.
Correct.
And if it doesn't work, you need to go back to the drawing board and make a news.
But then that's just as valuable because that's a really great insight. Like, the whole point is we're just trying to do ourselves service to our users.
Mm.
And if we were wrong, at least we know we're wrong. And then we can improve upon that. That's also really helpful.
Is that mentality prevalent in terms of, does product managers think like that? Because a lot of leaders don't think like that because they think, oh, it was a big mistake. I'm not going to get promoted.
Maybe. I think this is where, again, going back to roadmaps and planning, if I was building a roadmap for an entire year and I was running this entire process over a year, that's a hell of a lot of pressure. Like if it failed, that's an entire year of work lost. Like yeah. I would feel like crap if that happened. So this is where by scoping it quarterly and then trying to do work on a monthly basis, then it's less of an impact. Oh no, we lost a month. Like that sucks, but we've had bigger issues.
Yeah.
So it makes it so it's okay to fail if it's especially small and like a progressional or like incremental.
Yeah.
And then that also means what's great with that too is then you get solutions out to your users earlier. So we talk a lot about like releasing things in milestones.
Yeah.
I can release part of a solution or part of the solution to the problem to my customers. And if it's responding well, that's a good sign the rest of it might add value. But if it doesn't, like I said, that's really good feedback. And then at least I didn't invest the rest of the stuff I had planned. Oh. Like then we can just figure out and adjust from there. We can pivot from there.
Do you really release the solution to everybody or just to a small fraction of your users?
Totally depends. Depends on the solution. Sometimes you have to release like at Kahoot, we had some issue. Like when two-step authentication came out, we had to release that to all of our users. That was necessary. That was a EU requirement that came down. So that had to be sent out to everyone. Yeah. But if you're doing something like part of the user journey and part of the user flow that doesn't have critical requirements like that, there's definitely no harm in releasing it behind either a feature flag or an A/B test, or even just testing with a couple of users before launching to mitigate that impact of launching to everyone.
Yeah. Okay.
That puts less pressure on it. So then if the idea is good or bad, it's no big deal.
Yeah. Okay. So, but I don't think we covered the part of making ideas. So you have the user story.
Yeah.
How do you create ideas? Obviously, you could use ChatGPT.
It's definitely a helpful assistant. Yeah. And assuming what you're asking ChatGPT is compliant within the company policies.
Yes.
Yeah. So I think so that kind of steps into the planning and the creative process and kind of the discovery stages. Some things are pretty obvious to scope. Like, let me rephrase that. Nothing's obvious. But when there's very definable problems, then the path to the solution might be more clear. But sometimes there isn't that clarity. So a great example is when ChatGPT and OpenAI kind of hit the market, it was right, like I said, when I started RDoC, we wanted to be able to adapt to that and be able to use these tools to help our customers. So then we did a hackathon and engineering came up with some great ideas and we were able to approach some of the problems we had with these tools in ways we hadn't thought of before because literally we never considered these tools and solutions before. Hmm. Alternatively, another way to do this is there's this great concept called the sprint. It's by Jason Knapp. It started with Google Ventures. And
he's actually been on this podcast before.
Are you serious?
Yes.
Wow.
Jake Knapp, I believe.
Jake Knapp. I'm sorry, my bad pronunciation. Wow, that is... that's really...
So you're standing on the...
I feel like $1 million right now hearing that. No, but it's really... That also is a very user-centricity model. So it allows you to just be really creative. And what's nice about those types of exercises, you literally stop your day-to-day work just to kind of pretend to be a user and think like a user.
That
and
takes
do that
a
kind
week.
Of stuff. It does. We've done modified versions. So what we do is we already know some of the problems that we have to solve. And we already have some clear needs in place. And sometimes we'll have those journeys defined. And so we'll have some of it kind of pre-vetted beforehand. And that keeps it not to a whole week. But I would argue a week would also be incredible. I would love to get to a stage where we could do it for the full week and see the full value of that.
Yeah, because that takes a lot of resources from the organization as well.
It is. It's very expensive.
Yeah.
So again, going to this point about incrementality, that's definitely... it's definitely incremental, but still a lot to ask.
Where have you found, in your experience, to have... where did you find the best solutions from your experience?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, if I were to generalize, when I'm at the solutioning stage, the best solutions I've come up with is when you have everyone in the room. I've literally been where we've had the engineer, the designer, me, and we've even had like the sales guy in the call or in the room figuring it out. Because when you have that diversity of ideas or of backgrounds and experience, you get ideas you would have never thought of.
So a workshop with all the...
Yeah. So a great example is at Kahoot, we had a large customer join our business and they wanted to use our product for a really big event and our product didn't scale for that kind of use case. And so we had to think about how to solve it. And I actually had a different... again, we should have done more user stories, but I had already a solution in mind of what we should probably do. But what I found was the discussion and the engineers came up with a really, really great solution. And it was a really clean and effective solution. It was way better than what I had thought of. Like, there's no way we wouldn't have come up with that together. But what was great is also because I was in the room with them, I could help in teeing that up as well. Like, they, as they were vetting and scoping it, I was setting expectations with stakeholders so that we were able to kind of execute on something that was quite original, and it was awesome.
But describe, you know, very specifically, did you get to that specific solution? What type of meeting was this?
Yeah. So, in this situation, like I said, we had a very clearly defined problem and need. It was already pre-scoped. It was already defined. This is the issue. We have this large customer. They want to use it for this particular interest. Our product doesn't. So essentially the challenge we had was they wanted to use it for a trivia contest asynchronously for up to 10,000 employees. And our product had a cap of 2,000 instances per game. So we needed to figure out how to make this product scale for this instance. And historically, there's always this belief, oh, it'd be really difficult to scale past 2,000 users in a game. That's really difficult. That's going to be very, you know, not feasible to do. So I just assumed that wasn't even an option. But then we got in the room, we had a very clear scope of requirements. Like, these are the big critical needs of the user. These are the critical needs of our customers. This is also typical needs for B2B customers that are trying to use the product in this way. And literally we're in the room and one of the engineers is like, we should just do this. And originally there was like some discussion and resistance, but through the conversation and through the discussion and exercise, we discovered that was actually probably the best solution.
So what's the solution to just add a zero to the total number of...
It was a very technical solution. Essentially, again, the biggest challenge of scaling from 2,000 simultaneous users to 10,000 is the technical feasibility of that. And that's always risky. But he had already been thinking about it. He had some ideas of ways that they could technically shape the product. And
And what was your solution?
I'm too embarrassed to say. I had some idea of kind of breaking up the product into different groups, but I think that would have created more headache and noise. It would have created more complexity, 100%. But this is also why I'm really glad we were all in the room together to figure that out, because this is ultimately what's going to be best for our users.
Yeah. So he actually proposed a solution to make an adjustment in the, like, to say OS,
I would say that the solution he came up with would require changes to the tech stack. Yeah. And so the challenge was, how could we execute this in a way without completely reshaping the tech stack, given the time constraints we had?
Yeah.
Because we, again, never wanted to do stuff for a year. And
this is a solution that you probably would never be able to generate, because you don't have...
I don't know the tech stack as well.
Exactly.
Not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all. So this is also where, like, but we had multiple engineers in the room and they were able to check each other, and we didn't come up with the agreement to that solution in that conversation, but rather the next step was to investigate it.
Yeah.
Because again, we're a team. At the end of the day, we want to do best by our users. We all need to be looking out for each other. So then it was about, how can we divvy up the work to investigate if this is truly possible? The stress tests, the technical scope, how can we make sure we're challenging each other so that our tech stack can still be operational and that the rest of our users aren't hurt by this?
So let's say you're a 10-person startup.
Yeah.
Should everyone be involved in if it's a problem in the happy path?
I think when you're a 10-person startup, you're wearing so many different hats, I can't imagine there being somebody who shouldn't be part of that. Like, there's always exceptions. Like, maybe you have somebody who's an expert at this one particular thing and that's their area and they can deliver a ton of work. So maybe that may not make sense. But it's really about playing to the strengths of the team and figuring out how you can solve that.
So your answer is yes.
I think so, but again, there's always edge cases, like classic product management. I'm like, never.
You
gotta be adaptable to every instance.
Yeah, you have a gravitation towards edge cases, or at least acknowledging that edge cases are...
People are people at the end of the day,
exactly.
And each person has different strengths and weaknesses, and I want to create an environment in which we're going to build the best outcome for our users, and most likely having everyone in the room is there, but if somebody wants to focus on a different aspect of the job and that's their area and strength and it doesn't necessarily apply, then we can divide and conquer as well.
Yeah.
So it's just about finding that balance.
So let's say you have this solution.
Yeah.
After this thorough process.
Yeah.
And you want to align this with the stakeholders.
Yes.
How do you do that?
So in this case, we had come up with the solution. It seemed optimal and ideal, but I still wanted to present the trade-offs of each option, because the idea is product management is a series of trade-offs, essentially.
Yeah.
Because there's always a risk with everything we build, and there's always the possibility that we might have to adjust our time for something else. So essentially what I did is I kind of shared this with stakeholders. I also highlighted some of the other options we were thinking of and why we weren't as motivated by those, or why we considered those not as strong of options, and then kind of presented to them.
Okay, like, so you present alternatives. 100%. Not just one solution.
Well, yeah, totally. Because even though this might have been the best technical solution, the stakeholders might have more knowledge to something I'm not privy to. Like, yeah, maybe there's another customer coming down the pipe that's also going to have a similar request and need some other aspect or requirement.
Yeah.
Like, maybe the investors have a different direction based off of competitors in the space. Like, I'm not quite sure. So the whole point is I'm trying to transfer the knowledge of what we've done in this operational aspect to the stakeholders in a way that's catered to their needs and the way that's catered to their line of thinking, kind of shaping the narrative to the audience. And so then it's about going to the stakeholders and aligning to them. Here's the TLDR, the too long didn't read summary of what we discussed. Here's the kind of things we're considering, and this is why we're most excited about this one.
So do the stakeholders decide them?
Yeah, in some ways. I think it's all about bringing alignment. Like, again, we're trying to do best by our users, and we want to build a company that scales.
Yeah.
And so there could be things that, like I said, I'm not privy to. So it's about pulling them into the conversation.
But shouldn't they be part of the... So shouldn't they come in a bit earlier? Shouldn't they be in the room, the meeting you talked about where everyone was present?
Potentially, like at a 10-person startup, the CEO might be into the weeds and into that degree of detail. Because essentially, if you think about knowledge as, if you think about, there's like essentially a horizontal and vertical axis. There's a breadth and a depth to knowledge.
Yeah.
As we go into the details, like the leadership may not need to know about, you know, the about rate limits, like, but they may want to know the general access of what you're trying to get. So the depth of knowledge and the depth of detail may not be as necessary. So they could be in the room, but most of that conversation might not be effective for them.
Of course, it depends on, you wouldn't have Larry Page in a
room. No, right. And also just depends on the issue too. Like, maybe this is a really critical issue. This accounts for 80% of our customers, then they should be in the room.
Yeah.
It really depends. Like, and that's, I hate saying that, but that's ultimately what it is. Like, product management is just, it's not like there's no like perfect sauce to this.
No. I mean, like, so when you present the solution to solution alternatives to the stakeholders, they probably should have some, you know, probably should have been involved somewhat in defining the problem.
100%.
Right?
Yeah. So they were part of that for sure. Like I said, in this particular example, some of it was predefined. It came down like, we sold this, this deal was sold. Here are some key requirements. These are the things they're interested in.
Yeah. So stakeholder should be, so stakeholders are a crucial part of defining the problem.
100%.
Yeah. Because if they're not, you can't just show up with some solutions to a 100%. Problem they don't agree with.
100%. And again, I'm talking about a specific example here where something was predefined.
Yeah.
You might have it on a more standardized basis. So at Ardoc, we follow OKRs, objectives and key results. And I love that model because it clearly defines to me what leadership is trying to solve.
Can you explain this model?
Totally. So
in 20 words. ChatGPT would do
that. Yes, you should ask her, not me.
Yeah.
So essentially, objectives and key results, the idea is it provides benchmarks and guidelines into how you're evaluating the company. And when you have these benchmarks and guidelines defined at different levels at the company, it can help in making sure that even on a day-to-day basis, you're prioritizing the right stuff.
Yeah.
So an objective is something you're trying to solve. Like, we want to drive more engagement in the platform. And then key results will be like increasing, you know, X part of the platform usage by 10%, you know, decreasing the amount of support tickets by X.
So the key results are, what are the numbers that will indicate that we are actually that we are achieving the objective?
Correct. And they're measurable, which is really critical. So that helps you definitively know whether or not you're hitting it. And again, whether or not, if you're not hitting it, that's still extremely insightful. So the idea is that at Ardoc, we follow the objectives and key results. Leadership sets those at the top every quarter. And then I'm aware of some of the planning. And then in product, we also set our own targets. And we have to make sure those align up to the company objectives.
Yeah.
If we're not tied up to the company objectives, then what are we doing?
So how do you do? So the leadership sets the objectives and the key results.
Yes.
And then what? What do you, let's say they hand it to you, and what do you do with it?
So then it's oftentimes the objectives are tied to really critical needs of the business. And so then it can help me in informing product and what we can do to make sure we're defining that. Yeah. What's really great is we have a really good feedback loop. So I already have a sense of some of the key challenges at the leadership level. And so we're already having conversations at the product level about that. And then what we do is we just literally put pen to paper at the beginning of each quarter and writing them down.
So are you taking care of one of the key results, for example?
I've set objectives that align, and I've set my own objective that has key results that are measured against that. Hmm. But that objective should align to the company objective.
Okay.
So, it should align to the key results of the company as well.
Yeah.
So I actually don't have a specific key result that I'm tied to, but this is also where we have this continuous feedback loop. So if they're not hitting their key results, then we can always evaluate and figure out what product can do to make that better.
So you have your own objectives.
Correct.
So you have objectives of the companies, and then you have the key results.
Yeah.
And then you have objectives under there, or?
So what we have is at the product team, we have the product goals, and then we have cross-functional teams. And each cross-functional team is extremely different depending on what they're trying to solve. They cover different aspects of the platform. We have different engineers and PMs that have different strengths and weaknesses, and they're each trying to kind of solve their own thing. Hmm. And then based off the scope of what their team covers, they have then set goals that align to the product objectives.
Yeah.
And so we do this in planning. And so right now we did a big review last week, and now we're kind of evaluating now, okay, based off this company objective and what we're trying to focus on in the product, how can we align these teams?
Hmm.
So right now what we're focused on, like I said, is, let me rephrase that. It's a balance, because essentially we're trying to create flexibility so that we can solve the problem to the best of our ability that aligns up to the company goals. But we're also trying to make it not so broad and ambiguous where we're trying to do everything. Yeah. So right now the focus on product is really around a couple steps within the user journey we really want to do well. And we want each team in some way, shape, or form lining up to those really core critical steps. And that's the focus. Because again, we also only have a quarter. Like we can't fix the entire product in one quarter.
No.
So to that spirit of incrementality, we're taking these two steps of the user journey, focus on those. And then at the end of the quarter, we'll decide whether or not we're able to move the needle or not in those two steps.
What are the benefits? So this is, this question is pretty, it's low, it's what do you call it? It's a leading question.
Yeah.
What benefits are there to having a C-suite that are organized and have good OKRs?
Yeah. So around this product planning, like we talked about, and building the roadmap, or let me rephrase that.
Does it make it easier for you if the
exactly.
C-suite has a
product management, you're essentially in the middle. You know, you're trying to make sure all the day-to-day people are like engineers, PMs, designers, everyone's playing to their strengths and they're operating well. You're also trying to align to the stakeholders and leadership because you want to make sure you're driving value for the leadership. And ideally, you have some predictability around that. Okay, I've built my roadmap for 3 months. Here's what I'm going to build. I'm excited to see this through. I have never been in a company where there hasn't been some externality that has shaped the roadmap in the quarter. Mm. It happens. You know, a customer could be at risk. You know, there's this whole market shift in AI. Like, there's always something that could happen.
Do you wait to the next quarter? Do you wait to the next quarter, or do you act immediately?
Well, it depends, but you know, it's a balance. You want to act. If there's an opportunity to act and do service to our customers, we should act. Yeah. But we also, if it's going to create a huge amount of noise and slow down the productivity of the teams, that's also a risk.
So no clear answer here.
There is no clear answer. But this is also where, to your point with leadership, you can either have the norm be like reactive noise. And if leadership isn't aligned and coordinated on that, it could just be a lot of reactive stuff going top down, which can make it really difficult to plan a roadmap. But if they're organized and they're planning and they have structure around them, what they're doing, it can provide structure. It can trickle down and create structure for the rest of the teams.
So let me hear, which leadership team is more organized, Aardark or Kahoot?
I don't think there's a direct answer because they're just such different companies and they're trying to solve different things. Again, like, Kahoot's in a unique position where they're trying to target B2C automated users and automated revenue, but then they also have a B2B business. And they've also done all these acquisitions. Like when I was there, we acquired Clever, which was, they have something like, I think like 60 or between some, they have more than half of the entire school districts tied to their product in the United States. Yeah. So that was a huge shift in making sure our sign-on flows worked with Clever sign-on flows as an example.
Did you use OKRs in Kahoot as well?
We didn't. We had like, but again, we also had different needs and different things we were trying to solve. Like we had a series of acquisitions and we were also doing a series of partnerships. So there was a lot of different kind of objectives we were trying to work for.
But you used them at Google, I presume.
We did use them at Google. We did. And
it's basically not invented at Google, but it's a big example of it is John Doerr who wrote the book.
Measuring What Matters. Matters. I literally have that book on my table. I haven't finished reading it.
No, and I think he was like one of the first investors in Google. And
he was
the one who introduced that concept.
That's exactly right. Oh my God, I don't even want to quote it because I think you know this. You're quoting it better than me.
No, not at all.
No, but it is quite powerful because what I like about the model is, one, it's something I'm familiar with, but two, it creates more structure and autonomy where I'm still accountable to the leadership. I'm still accountable to the stakeholders. They've given me this directive that this is their way of measuring the company. So whatever I do this quarter has to direct to that. Whatever the teams do has to direct towards that.
Yeah.
If we're not directing towards that, then we're not doing our goal. We're not achieving our goal. But I have autonomy to figure out how to solve that.
Yeah.
So then I can go, okay, my area of strength is I know product and I know our users and I'm focusing on our user journey. Where is it breaking? How can I make an impact on our user journey that's going to get us the biggest bang for our buck on this outcome?
Yeah.
And again, like I said, there's noise. So when you've really invested in the OKR process, it can work really, really well and create predictability. But even then, like I said, noise happens. Things happen. And everyone, I think when you go into that expectation with that in mind, or if you go in with that kind of expectation, you can adapt and you can adjust easier.
Yeah. What happens when you have to pivot the product?
Yeah, so pivoting is hard.
So what is pivoting, actually?
So sometimes there's a lot of, like, pivoting is essentially when you change direction, when you're focusing on something else and you're changing to a different direction. Sometimes it could be small, like you've realized where our solution doesn't align to the original problem we're trying to solve based off this user feedback. We need to pivot to our solution. Kind of like when I gave with that example with Kahoot, with the idea I had was actually not the strongest idea, we pivoted. But in some cases, you might even have to pivot within a company. And when you're in a relatively younger company, there's a greater likelihood of pivoting because product market fit is just so difficult to achieve.
Yeah, so pivoting is more of a strategical move, right?
Correct.
It's a bigger move. Like, okay, we thought about you doing this, but it doesn't work. So we need to do this in terms of the value proposition to
100%.
The customer. Yeah. So it's a value proposition, actually.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah. You want to make sure, again, your goal is to try and drive value to your users. And sometimes you might have to completely rethink that strategy.
Because you were at the start where you didn't have product market fit.
Correct. So I joined really early. It was either pre-seed or just around Series A. As that involved, I was really drawn to it. It was they were trying to drive user engagement, employee engagement.
Well, so what did this startup do?
So originally, they're trying to drive employee engagement by trying to bring in partnerships with nonprofits locally to try and create better connections within the company through volunteering activities. And through helping nonprofits. And I loved that. It was just so altruistic. And I was really motivated to try and do something professionally that was also, you know, for good. But ultimately, they didn't have product market fit.
So how didn't they have product market fit?
Some signals, for example, it was really difficult to sell. And it was hard to get customers in the door. And then when we did get customers in the door, the feedback requests were these huge lists and they weren't consistent and they all had different things.
Hmm.
And so it put us in a position where it'd be really difficult to scale. And when I look at that, those were big indicators that we weren't really getting a natural flow and path of user behavior. And so we realized kind of that we had to rethink what we were trying to solve. And so to kind of go through that process, me and the founders, we interviewed 300 potential customers or actual customers to really vet what problems they were dealing with. And what we found was that they, like, and this is probably seems obvious now, but they are having challenges trying to make good decisions and trying to get the right information and communication through the different levels of the company to make sure that those decisions were accurate. And so...
So you need to explain that, because what they did was actually they were connecting companies to charitable
organizations,
exactly, to drive employee engagement.
Yeah, but again, the critical factor there was we wanted to drive up employee engagement. So we were tracking a lot on what employees were doing and how employees were engaging within a company.
So the charity part was just this. One of the potential solutions.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Yeah. And so you went back to the original...
the employee engagement piece. Yeah. How do we drive this behavior?
Yeah.
And then we realized that there was a disconnect between the employee level and the leadership level. And one example that we saw was sometimes the disconnect between the sales activity and what the end stakeholders wanted.
Yeah.
And... this was at a time when we were actually also looking into AI. I had done the whole machine learning course with Andrew Ng. One of the founders had an AI thesis basis, and we thought this is an opportunity where we could potentially build an NLP model to try and help and create more informed decisions or solutions that could create a solution that could create more informed decisions for the stakeholders.
So what would be an example for
So we essentially were looking at... when I was there, we're prototyping it with one customer where we were looking at all their sales data and then trying to identify common threads of activity. We basically built a classification model out of it to then identify common threads and performance activity from sales to then understand and build trends around that. So like, here's the key insights we see from top performers. And we found that performed really well. And that it had a stickiness factor where the customers were very invested in it and they were continuously eager to see more. And I think that's what they've built their entire company off of moving forward. Like, if you check out their website, it's all about just trying to understand customer centricity, like customer retention, creating that engagement using AI, which is super cool.
That's pretty different from charity.
100%. But again, it's about doing right by our users and doing right for these companies. And, you know, we got to make sure there's kind of this, like the Reforge model talks about three things. You need to have commercial value, you need to have product fit, and then user fit. And you need all three for a company to survive.
Yeah.
And it's just about kind of finding a combination where there's a need and a value you can provide.
But you went to work with that company because it was so altruistic.
Yeah.
And now it's totally different.
It is. But I think they're still trying to do the right thing. Like, people are still trying to do good jobs.
Yeah.
And employees still want to be good at what they're doing and engage with their employer.
You often connect the solution to the company, not the problem.
Correct, but this is also, it was a B2B model. Like, again, like we said in the very beginning, your decision maker and your end users might be different.
Yeah.
So you still have to sell the product. Like, we still have to get the contract sold.
Yeah.
Like, we're not going to be here if we can't get the contract sold.
No, that's
true. But at the same time, we have to make sure that the employees are engaging and using it. So, and providing value for their day-to-day jobs as well.
So if you're having really problems with sales and you understand that this is not going as it should be going, then it's time to stop up and think, to interview potential customers like you did, like 300.
We did 300 at least. I think there was a few more, but it was really just to be really thorough. Like, we wanted to...
Did everyone in the company interview, or was it just a small team who did that?
It was a small team, but everyone in the company was part of the solutioning.
Yeah.
Like, when we were building these models, we literally had everyone labeling with us, trying to build it.
Yeah.
But it was a team effort for sure. Again, to that point, it's a balance between getting the right people in the room, but also making sure everyone's included, because that's where you get the best ideas.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So then you pivoted to this new solution.
Yeah.
And then now it's still, this company is still working on this.
Yeah. They did another round of fundraising, closed some deals. And so that's always a good sign. I haven't really kept in touch too much. I moved from, this was all in the States in California, and I moved from California to Norway, and I had two kids. So different priorities, but it seems like it's going really well.
Yeah. Okay. So do you ever dream about starting a startup?
Oh, I don't know. Not right now. I'm really happy where I am, and my kids are a lot.
Yeah, that's two startups.
That's a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, your kids.
But I think the big thing here is in product management, you're kind of, like I said, you have this view of the assembly line because you work with so many people. So for me, like, I love being in an environment where I'm working with really great people and where, you know, we're all challenging each other in the right way and trying to solve hard problems. Like, ultimately, like, again, I think if you asked me that question 5 years ago, I would have been like, yes, I'm going to be a CEO. Yes, I'm going to launch my company. But, you know, right now it's about just trying to solve good problems and having a good time doing it and being with people who I can enjoy solving them with.
Yeah. I mentioned that we were supposed to talk about prioritization as well. We touched upon that.
Sure.
But just to make it, we can do it quickly. So there are a lot of prioritization models,
which
tells you how to prioritize if you need to decide between two, for example, product features.
Totally. Yeah. I think we even talked about like RICE and Moscow. Yeah. Like, there's many.
And you told me that there is one framework that actually works every time.
No, there is no framework.
I'm just kidding.
No. Those frameworks are great. Like they're a good kind of starting point. Mm. It's kind of like the classic like academic versus reality situation. Yeah. And like, again, if I was in a perfect company that didn't have reactive needs and that could follow a waterfall model perfectly, then those models are brilliant in that sense. But ultimately, like, things happen, you know, the EU might distribute down a new way to verify payments that you have to adapt to.
Yeah.
OpenAI can come into the market. Maybe you get a huge customer contract that you have to adapt to. Like, these things make it really difficult for these models to fit within that perfect realm.
I just came up with a new, what do I call it? A new, not a slogan, but a quote. This is, you can quote me on this.
I'll take it.
So, things happen, we'll eat frameworks for breakfast.
Okay, there you go. We'll eat frameworks for breakfast. I love it. Isn't there that classic like culture? There's another quote about that. Like,
yeah, culture, exactly. Culture eats strategy for breakfast.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
I love it. It's well timed, good considering this is the morning.
So, because you're a big proponent of that things happen.
Totally. Well, I think the big thing is, like, at the end of the day, people are people. And we are humans, we are prone to human error, and, you know, there's no perfect system because of that. And so I'd like to think that there's some framework that can solve all my life's problems or at least my business problems. Ultimately, we're all prone to this human behavior. And so it's just about supporting each other and making sure that we're all looking out for each other and trying to solve this and keeping each other honest and making sure we're having good dialogue so that these problems can be addressed.
So let's say we go back to this utopia place.
Totally.
Where there are no externalities that can influence the product or decision. So what would be a way to prioritize one feature over another feature?
So, again, kind of going back to that framework, you want to have commercial needs met. It needs to fit within the product, and then also has to fit within it has to have a user centricity.
Could you have like different values in terms of commercial fit, user fit, and commercial fit?
100%.
For example, 0 to 10, and then you can rate the different features in term, and then the highest score wins.
Totally, and I think that's what those models are trying to do. Is they're all trying to basically measure against those three kind of core requirements, and then. Depending on the model, it just helps you in stack ranking the options.
So user fit, what is user fit?
It's more about user centricity. The idea is that it needs to provide meaning to users. Yeah. There has to be, like, so commercial fit's obvious. It has to make money for the business.
Make money, yeah.
Product fit means that it has to actually work within the product. Like, I can't be in, you know, gaming software and then suddenly pivot to commercial brick and mortar stuff.
So feasibility.
Exactly. And then the last one's user centricity, meaning it has to fit within the user's needs. So I could be in EdTech, for example, and I could put something in there about healthcare.
Yeah.
But if it doesn't align to the user's needs, like, they're coming there to try and play games, they're not really going to care about this. They're not really going to adopt it. Oh. So that's more of an extreme example. But the idea is that it has to fit. It has to be easy enough for the users to understand when they're coming in with the mindset of using your product so that it adds value to them, where they're going, oh, yeah, this is why I'll use this product.
Yeah. So, but as if I understand you correctly, you haven't almost never been in a situation where there are no externalities consider.
No, not really. I think Google is probably the one where that's closest to that environment because, again, the scale you have at Google is enormous. And so when you release a feature, if there's anything wrong with it, not only do you lose the opportunity revenue of that feature, but then it could impact, because it's all one product, like the AdWords problem is all one platform, it could have negative implications to other components of the system. So everything is done very cautiously because of that risk.
Yeah.
So in that sense, that required a lot of planning and a lot of investment, but there were still reactive things. Like I remember when we were trying to launch that, we realized we were originally going to target one particular segment, and we realized one country would be impacted. An entire country wouldn't be able to use the product. and so we actually went to that market and investigated it and like spoke with the customers. And we essentially, like, so that did, it was part of the planning. It was, you could argue that was a bit.
Imagine having this impact.
Totally.
Entire
and
countries.
Then, but at least we're able to gather that information and then make a trade-off decision, or look at the trade-offs and then make a decision based off of that.
So an important thing is to actually understand the trade-offs.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. But again, like, you could argue that could be reactive. You could argue that wasn't reactive because it technically wasn't released yet. But it, like again, that's the whole point is we're in a world where things happen and we're caught by surprise. And as humans, we're caught by surprise every day. And, you know, it's just about supporting each other and trying to figure out how to mitigate those surprises.
Yeah. Okay, Melissa, we're going to stop here.
Sure.
I would love to invite you back because there's a lot of things we could discuss.
Oh, that's great. I hope this was helpful, and I hope this is helpful for your listeners.
It was very,
we'll see.
Very, very good.
We'll be iterating and testing off of this.
Absolutely. We got insights into product roadmap creation, prioritization, how to pivot when your startup doesn't have product market fit, but also we delved into the how you go from a problem to a solution, the journey.
Yeah.
And so thank you very much, Melissa.
Well, thank you for having me.
I wish you the best at Ardoc. I hear it's going really well.
Oh, I hope so. But we'll see. Let's stay focused.
Yeah. So thank you very much and good luck. And we'll speak to you again in
the
future.
Great. Awesome. Thanks so much for having me, Lucas.
Thank you. Hei, hvis du likte denne episoden, så abonner på den og gi den gjerne en 5-stjerners rating med dine tanker. Hvis du interessert I temaene vi tar opp på denne podcasten, så anbefaler jeg deg å gå inn på skifter.no. Og hvis du mener vi fortjener det, så kan du gjerne støtte oss ved å abonnere på Skifter. Takk for at du hørte på, så ses vi neste uke.